Hello and welcome to another edition of The Art of Action. And today I am joined by Mr. Jeff Speakman. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. I really appreciate you coming on my show. As I've said to you previously, The Perfect Weapon, when that came out in 1991, it was actually a great time to be a fan of martial arts films. I mean, obviously, we had Van Damme and we had Seagal doing big numbers at the box office. Their films right. Get released all over the cinemas. I do remember The Perfect Weapon coming out, seeing the trailer, and seeing this new guy with Kenpo Karate. And man, did that film blow me away. Absolutely brilliant film, especially to watch it, you know, as a teenager. Fantastic movie. I've seen it so many times. So again, I really appreciate you being here, sir.
It is such a pleasure to be here. Thank you for your kind words. And I also feel the same about you. I have great respect for you. You have a stellar reputation in the martial art world and even on the inside martial art business. You have a wonderful reputation. So good on you for that, because as a sure, you know, many people in this industry, movie business, don't have a very good reputation. So yeah. It's a to meet you at last.
And I appreciate that. Actually, there's a scene in The Perfect Weapon, not with you, actually, but when the younger version of your character goes up against the American football player and kicks him in the helmet. That always stayed with me, so much so that I actually put that scene into a movie that I wrote and produced called Accident Man. I fight a guy, comes off a motorbike and he has a helmet on. And the inspiration was The Perfect Weapon. So that's how much of a fan I am.
That is great. That is great. I remember the day we shot that scene. Memorable because, of course, that was my first movie, so nobody knew who I was. And the actor who was playing the football player guy certainly had a chip on his shoulder. You know, he was... Yeah, absolutely. So when I was going over the details with the actor played the younger Jeff of how to do a jump spinning outward crescent kick, I had my cowboy boots on. So this guy giving us a bunch of lip, I stepped in for him and I said, okay, and I'm talking to the actor. I said, you don't mind if I, you got the helmet on, so it's okay, right? He said, yeah. So I let one fly and I cracked him as hard as I could because I had my cowboy boots. And so I could lay one on. And I think he had a little more respect after that.
Man, where was the behind the scenes guy for that moment? That would have been quality.
Yeah, it was.
Well, what I do with all my guests, Mr. Speakman, is I get them to just briefly, if possible, run through their martial arts background. Of course, you are very esteemed and maybe we don't have enough time, but I would just love to hear, if you can encapsulate your martial arts journey. I'm obviously very interested to hear about your relationship with Ed Parker and Kenpo Karate and everything about that, if you don't mind.
Sure. I'll give you the Reader's Digest version, as it were. It was 1978 when I began studying Japanese Goju-Ryu in Joplin, Missouri, which is where I was attending the university there. And I had a friend who I thought was so interesting because I knew this guy like 2 years really, really well. And I never knew that he knew martial arts. And all of a sudden in conversation, it comes out that he's a black belt in Goju-Ryu under this gentleman named Lou Angel. And it so impressed me that he never let on at all whatsoever. I went, okay, see, that's the mentality, that's the attitude that I appreciated. So he actually started to teach me first, and then I became a student of Lou Angel. and then in 1981 is when I got my black belt from him.
How old were you then, sorry?
23 or 24 back then. Okay. I started when I was 21.
Okay.
So then graduating from the university in my undergraduate degree in psychology, Angel said to me, if you want to make martial arts your life, you should move to California and study from Ed Parker, this art called Kenpo, because at that time he considered him the best in the world and he had a previous relationship with him. So he wrote me a letter of introduction. I sold my car to pay for the U-Haul truck threw a little bit of furniture I had in there and moved out to California, lived with a friend, went up to Ed Parker at this huge tournament he put on every year in Long Beach, California, bowed very deeply to him and handed him this letter of introduction from Lou Angel. He looked at me very strange, of course. But once he saw that it was from Lou Angel, he was so pleased. And, oh, my old friend. And so he, on the back of his business card, he wrote his home phone number. He said, give me about 2 weeks when this is over. Give me a call and I'll get started, which is what I did. And then I began my Kempo training at the West Los Angeles School just a couple of weeks later in 1983.
And for our listeners that don't know, Mr. Ed Parker was referred to as the godfather of American karate, right?
Right, the father of American karate. That was actually a term that was coined for him back in the early 60s when he was doing an interview with a magazine. And after extolling the virtues of what he had done with Kempo by Americanizing it, by bringing the science and the physics and the principles in, this interviewer said, well, then you must be the father of American karate, because it was the American point of view, you know, of how to bring science and physics and impact and cause and effect relationships into play that made it stand out from all other martial arts, independent of their legacy and their legend. It was a truly, back then, it was a truly unique time in the martial arts. And Ed Parker was the only one who brought this Americanization, the scientific application to ancient martial art techniques and traditions. I think of him as the Einstein of martial arts. His mind was so far advanced. We lost so much when he died so early at age 59. But the interesting thing is, because the system he developed is based on science and physics and cause and effect relationships, he then created a message for all of us, all of his black belts. He wanted us to evolve the art over time and change the art to meet the conditions of the day so that Kempo would remain an extremely practical street art. So the idea of evolving the art of Kempo is completely natural to it. The bizarre thing is, so many of the Ed Parker black belts, many of them are my senior, have not evolved it at all. They just continue to teach the same thing he was teaching 30, 40, 50 years ago and even beyond. We're the ones who have evolved the art to include grappling and ground fighting. And in short, Kempo 5.0, which is what I teach, is the fifth evolution of Kempo Karate, once again directed by Ed Parker to evolve and change with the times. One of his famous quotes is, when I'm gone, I hope no one traditionalizes my art. And yet, almost all of his black belts have done exactly that. So we've moved on with this fifth evolution of Kempo called Kempo 5.0, which is how to adapt and evolve Kempo to be able to fight an MMA guy versus just a drunk in the street.
Yeah.
So we say, you know, Kempo 4.0 is the drunk in the bar. Kempo 5.0 is the drunk MMA guy in the bar.
Yeah.
So there are stand-up techniques like this in Kempo 5.0. And then there are a host of ground techniques founded and based in here. You're looking at a technique where it starts standing up and then you voluntarily take him to the ground. This is a thing that Kempo Karate does not have. Any of this. You see two guys rolling around on the floor doing jiu-jitsu kind of things and MMA kind of things. You see zero of this in a Kempo school. And it is ridiculous because Kempo has always taken the position that we are the preeminent street art. And it always was, except when the Gracies came and brought their version of Brazilian jiu-jitsu, which morphed into MMA. Then we just fell by the wayside because we didn't have a ground system. So that's what we did. I collected information with all of my students. Many of them were grapplers and wrestlers and MMA guys. I studied jiu-jitsu for 4 years in Los Angeles. And then we came together and evolved the art of Kempo to now include ground fighting. And although it looks very, very much like jiu-jitsu and or MMA, it really is different in detail once you hit the ground. Because remember, jiu-jitsu and MMA are sports. So they have rules. We're an art, so we have no rules. So what we did was we learned the rules of those sports, found out where they were vulnerable, like attacking the groin, for example. And then we included that in our system of techniques to exploit those temporary weaknesses. So Kempo 5.0 is a ground fighting system made for, of, and by Kempo people. And yet, even though all that's true, what I just told you, virtually none of the rest of the Kempo world has adapted what we're doing. They still remain doing the Kempo that was being done 40 or 50 years ago, even though that is really against the wishes of Ed Parker.
So it really sounds like you just made your mind up at early 20s that, yes, this is what I found, what I want to do with my life. I want to dedicate it to martial arts. It's going to be karate. And this guy's the top karate guy. I'm going to go and learn from the best.
You just said it exactly correct. It was, I grew up as a gymnast and a competitive springboard diver all through high school. So I was, definitely in that game of motion and gymnasts and gymnastic type of movement. So when I went away to college, I was either going to go into some kind of professional dance or into martial arts. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I happened to meet this guy who introduced me to Lou Angel. And the moment I took my first class, I knew that all my life I would do martial arts. It was just a given, of course, never knowing that I would wind up here, but so is such is life. But yes, you're quite correct. I knew instantly that this was the thing I would do all my, I'd be a lifer, you know?
Yeah. Well, this is it. I feel very fortunate that I found what my passion was at an early age and knew exactly what I wanted to do. I think, I feel sorry for people that don't get the opportunity to just grab onto something and go, this is it for me.
Right.
It makes life a lot easier. That's for sure.
Boy, you said it. I agree 200%.
Yeah. So in terms of the films, did you ever have any aspirations to do anything like that as a youngster growing up, or did it kind of come out of the blue? What was the whole thing there?
You know, I never did. I never thought that much of myself, to be honest with you. So it came totally out of the blue. It was because of my relationship with Ed Parker, who, was played the ninja in Blake Edwards' series of movies and had taught many, many stars in Hollywood. But even still then, I never thought I would be involved in that industry. Then finally, someone who was bringing their child to the West LA studio where I taught, she kept watching me teach and she came up and said, you ought to take what you do and go study some acting because I've never seen anything like that. And I kind of avoided it because that just wasn't my spirit at that time. But then she came back and said, look, here, friends of mine who own an acting studio, just go watch, just go look and then see what you think. So I went and right away, my first night, as soon as I saw that, I knew I wanted to get up there and do that. How far it would go, I didn't know. But because my undergraduate degree was in psychology, I'm curious about human behavior, even to a fault. And this seemed to be a way that I could investigate more about myself, from a behavioral standpoint, because acting teaches you things about yourself that you'll never get exposed to through any other exercise.
So how long did you study acting before something like The Perfect Weapon came along?
Almost 5 years. It took me a couple of years to get my skills to the level where I could go out on auditions and not embarrass myself. Yeah. Because that's the big mistake young actors make, is they go out on auditions before they're ready. And then that leaves an impression in a very small group of people who make movies. That leaves a negative impression in their mind. So to overcome that is tough. So you've got to be ready first, then start going on auditions. Now, for me, I never let anybody knew that I knew martial arts, because I knew that I would have to prove myself as an actor, and then the martial arts that I bring to the table would be seen as an asset, as opposed to look at me, a martial artist trying to act. It was actually the same weekend. Remember Van Damme's first movie?
Bloodsport?
Yeah. Right, exactly. So right when I'm contemplating getting into acting, ironically, his first movie comes out. So I went, okay, so I went to Westwood, California, where UCLA is, and I went to the movie theater by myself. And I said, all right, here's a new guy. Let me watch that, and I'll think of it with a different mind of what I like to try doing that. And when I saw what he was doing on film that got him that work, I thought to myself, my God, if people like this, wait till they see Kenpo.
Yeah.
Because that jump spinning kick and a, you know, a basic block punch kick. It had no sophistication to it whatsoever. But he was, and I'm sure still is, a tremendous athlete, an absolute phenomenal athlete in every way. But his martial arts skills are incredibly limited. So I thought, wow, if we bring out a real martial art, not a martial sport, you know, he was just a kickboxer. So that's really martial sport. Very, very different from martial art. I thought if I could bring out actually a martial art, then people would understand the difference between martial sport and martial art, and, you know, on would go the journey. So that was my motivation anyhow.
Well, just sticking with Van Damme for a second, because you were in Lionheart, otherwise known as Able in the UK. Now, I've watched it and I can't see you, but I can hear your voice. Yeah, my I couldn't see you, but I could hear you.
Ms. Caldera, the house would like to have a word with you regarding your unsecured marker. This way, please.
You find that bitch, don't let her off the premises.
She's headed toward the front door now, sir.
I wasn't in as a martial artist. This was during the many years where I studied acting and I went on auditions and got work. No one had any idea I knew martial arts whatsoever, because it was important to me to prove that I could get work as an actor, that I could get paid, that the paycheck would clear at the bank, you know, all those, you know, the joke in LA is you say, oh, what do you do? And they go, oh, I'm an actor. And you go, oh, great. What restaurant do you work at?
Yeah.
That's the joke, right? So I didn't want to be a joke. So once you audition cold, you get hired, you work, you get paid, the check clears the bank. Okay, now you're a working actor. You've actually proved something that's really, really big. So I wanted to prove that on several occasions. And one of the tricks that you learn as an actor in LA is if you volunteer your time as a reader to a casting director. So you sit in the audition room next to the, you're the actor reading off camera, as they say. So the director and everybody's looking at the actor audition. Then there's another actor sitting off next to them at the table reading the other line. Well, I volunteered to do that on several occasions. And that was the smartest thing I ever did, because here's the main, I learned what they are looking for.
Yeah.
What the directors and the producers, because every time the actor leaves, of course, you're a part of listening to the conversation they're having. This is what I like. This is what I didn't like. And you get to see, okay, now I see why people are hired. Now I get to now use that skill. Well, it turned out that the casting director I was working with did the Van Damme movie. So I was in that movie as a limousine driver, had, I think, one or two lines, and that was it. And that was my pay. You have to work for free. But what they do is they guarantee you a small role in the movie, a couple of lines. Well, that gets you film exposure.
Right? Is there a problem here?
Yeah,
I guess so.
It just turned out that the acting workshop that I was studying at, one of the guys running the video lab down there, he was the guy that wrote Van Damme's second movie, Kickboxer. So I see this guy twice a week. We sort of become friends. He's coaching me and helping me in my acting. And so because I found out he wrote a martial art movie, I said, hey, I know martial arts too. And we started talking. And then one night he just said, you know, I really want to see what you do. I said, great. So he came down to the West LA dojo and watched it. And he said, that's it. He went back to the guy who produced Van Damme's first three movies, which is how he knew him, because the second movie was Kickboxer that he wrote. And he said, you got to see this Kenpo stuff. This is the next way to go. So it took him a bit, but he got this producer named Mark DeSalle convinced. He came down to the dojo and watched me.
Was he the director for Kickboxer?
I believe he did. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So
this beginning, and I signed a 4-picture deal with him. And then he, through another connection, took that 4-picture deal to Paramount and said, look, I made a star of Van Damme. This guy's everything Van Damme isn't in the martial art world, and he can act, and 5 years of studying, and blah, blah, blah. So Paramount picked up all four of those options that he had, and the first one ultimately wound up being The Perfect Weapon. So that was a movie that was written for me at Paramount.
I have a very important question to ask, probably the most important of the day. The I Have the Power song. How much do you hate that song now? That song has followed you around for your whole life.
Yeah. You get the award for the only guy who has ever asked me that question. Everybody, I love it now, how much I hate it.
It's about every time when you walk into a room, they introduce you and they play this music.
Exactly. They do. That's exactly what they do. Yeah. And, you know, I understand it for what it was and what it is. And it's very meaningful to many people. And so I enjoy it from that perspective.
Is this a form that exists in Kenpo Karate?
It is actually a combination of two forms that exist in Kenpo Karate. The brown belt form, number 4, and the third degree black belt form, number 6. But in the middle of this form, I stop and I do some Goju-Ryu moves that you probably will recognize because they look so incredibly different from everything else. I did that knowing that Lou Angel would be sitting in a movie theater in Joplin, Missouri, watching this for the first time, and he would see Goju-Ryu moves right in the middle of a Kenpo form, and he would know that that's a salute and a show of respect to him.
It seems a lot more flowy, the kata in Kenpo, to other karate or taekwondo.
It's certainly that. And it's history. Kenpo's history and origin is what you're really talking about. It came from China, as I mentioned earlier, then to Japan, and then to Hawaii, and then to the mainland United States. So we really are a Chinese-based system, which is why you see those kind of movements.
Okay, yeah. Lots of circular movements. Beautiful to look at.
Yeah,
great place to open the movie as well. If you're opening up with a form, you know you're in for a proper martial arts movie.
Right, right, yeah. I mean, you really have to give a lot of credit to Mark DeSalle, who was the producer and director of this and who produced Van Damme's films prior to this, because he recognized, he was not a martial artist, but he recognized what the essence was that made Van Damme a success. So his perspective was applied here. He let me do what I do. I choreographed all the fight scenes. I even had final edit and sound check of all the fight scenes, which is really amazing because this is my first movie. Yeah. I'm with a company as big as Paramount who would never let an actor come in and edit anything, but they completely turned over the editing bay to me when it came to the martial art fight scenes. So I had final edit and final sound check for all of them.
Seems like they fell in love with the idea of exposing Kenpo to the world and wanted to fall in line with what you guys, obviously, you know, you're the best guys to talk about how to portray the art. So
yes, a very big thrust of Paramount was the authenticity that collectively what we brought to the table. Arthur Cohen was the gentleman who was in charge of marketing at that time at Paramount. So they decided to put me on the road because Mr. Parker had just passed away. So I went all over the world. I went to 33 cities in 30 days in the United States just to do the opening of the movie. So they hired people to train me of how to speak in public. They put a lot of money and a lot of time into prepping me for this. And then I know in other speeches that Arthur Cohen gave, he really said the smartest money we spent on Perfect Weapon was teaching Jeff Speakman about public speaking because that sold the movie.
Well, that's a good skill to have. I'm sure that sold you well for the rest of your time, yeah?
You're absolutely right. And that's well into my world of psychology and human behavior. And I was able to follow it easily. But that's a skill set that I will use every day of my life.
This is a brilliant fight scene. How many days did you spend on this?
This was 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
How much would you like to have 2 weeks to do a fight scene?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Luxury.
There you go. When you work with, you know, a company that's got $1 billion in cash in the bank, you can afford to take 2 weeks to do one fight scene. In my subsequent movies after my career with Paramount did not move forward, I was still tied to Mark DeSalle, so I had to do much, much smaller budgeted movies. So 2 weeks turned into 2.5 days, 3 days if you're lucky.
That's where I'm at, 2.5 days. Yeah, it's, yes. I mean, it was more difficult then as well with the film cameras.
Yeah, exactly, as opposed to shooting everything on tape that they do today. but, you know, talk about the luxury. However, remember, you're talking about 8 or 10 hours a day, or maybe more, of nothing but fight scenes. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Those were tough days.
Day three is the toughest, right? For me, day three is the one where it's, oh, I can't get out of bed.
In order to get what you're looking at, what we would call street speed, I had to get amped every single take. We would do over 100 setups a day, which is an enormous amount. And so I wound up resorting to a trick that I learned when I used to participate in powerlifting, which is just before you get up to do your lift, you take an ammonia cap, snap it open, and take a hit in your nose, inhale the ammonia. And that makes your adrenaline rush. It opens all of the capillaries in your body.
These guys then.
So that was the, so I'd be standing there, we'd rehearse it, the cameras are ready, the sound is ready, the lights are ready, the stuntmen are rehearsed, we're about ready to shoot. Last thing I would do is grab an ammonia cap, snort it, throw the ammonia cap off to the side, get cranked, and hit it. And luckily nobody got hurt, including me.
Well, some of it looks quite, I wouldn't say full contact, but there's definitely contact here with James Lewis. I mean, yeah. This proper Kenpo here hits him with the knife hands, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, there was, when it came to body and legs, there was heavy contact.
It looks like it's contact to his face there.
But I got hit a lot too. Yeah. But when it came to face stuff, you know, you, of course, made no contact there. But even to the groin and other places, as long as everybody was padded up, we went ahead and made contact because look how good it looks when somebody, like right there, it gets stomped in the kidney. I really got hit. Yeah. And so they were taking their shots because I just got through hitting them a bunch. So they said, all right, you know, my turn.
Payback time.
It's a good thing that I was raised in Kenpo because it's a very heavy contact based art, much of it with empty hands, without gloves.
The choreography is fantastic though, because it's very visual and striking, yet it feels very real. And this particular sequence right here, and you can see where there's different camera angles that come into play, which really help. But I love this sequence as you break him down from top to bottom.
Yes, this is become a favorite technique in the Kenpo 5-0 world called charging maces. So it's a way to move in and attack a fighter. You know, most systems, just like Kenpo, they're defense-based. So you move and I defend. Well, that isn't the case in Kenpo 5-0. There are many techniques that we have where we begin the fight. So if you find yourself squared off with a fighter and you sit there and wait for him to move first, the chances are you're going to get hit and you're not going to like it. So we teach people to move first. Don't wait. If you're in a fight, go to take him out. Go right to the groin or to the neck or to the throat first, not as a default mechanism. Kenpo is an extremely aggressive, practical street art that is not a sport.
So if you know it's going to be a fight, be first.
Then be first and go to serious targets to deflect your opponent, to distract your opponent, because there may be more than one opponent, because once again, you're trained for fighting in the street. So we will go to the ground in Kenpo 5-0. We know what we're doing down there, but we'll only go there as a default. In the street, I will not choose to go to the ground and smother somebody and try to beat him up sitting on top of him, because his friend can come alongside and kick me in the side of the head, and it's over. So we still are a stand-up art, but now we have a very robust ground game to go with the stand-up art that we have, which I would suggest to you, that's why we are as successful as we are. Many other Kenpo schools who have not adopted and adapted the new way of thinking, they're all going out of business, because what 17-year-old kid is going to walk in and go, how do you guys fight on the ground? They go, well, we don't do that here. Oh, thank you. Goodbye. You know, they're just going to go down the street and go to the local MMA school. Because everybody knows if you don't know how to fight on the ground and you get in a street fight with one of those guys, you're dead.
Yeah.
You're not coming out of an MMA fight against a fighter unless you know what you're doing on the ground. You're going to get creamed. Yeah. And you know, after 4 years of jiu-jitsu, I can say I got creamed many times. You know, I put on a white gi and a white belt, and I went into my jiu-jitsu class, and I got killed every night I went in there. But I learned. I learned by doing.
I heard you say that this sequence was a bit more like what Kempo would be like in real life in the crop pit.
Yes.
And how much did you stick to what Kempo would probably be like, and then how much did you, like, try to make it a bit more cinematic?
I spent zero time making Kempo more cinematic. Everything you watch me do in all my movies is exactly what we do in our dojos all around the world. These are Kempo techniques as they're taught and as they're executed in all Kempo schools around the world. It was a real challenge that we faced in The Perfect Weapon, because when you are going to show a hit, like a strike to the face, they want you to make a really big circle because it's easier to see. And then, of course, it's a miss. You don't hit people in the face. And they put a sound effect in and the stuntman dummies up correctly, and you got a great looking hit. But I didn't want to make a big circle because Kempo is known for its small circles, which is how we move so fast. So it was a very small sliver of opportunity that the cameraman had to be in exactly the right place to be able to capture the action, not have it hidden by the stuntman, and where I still was able to stay within the framework of correct motion in Kempo.
I remember you saying in maybe the making of Bruce Lee had the nunchucks, and we're bringing out the sticks. Is that something from Kempo Karate? Because I thought that it was a screamer or Filipino type martial art or something like that.
Right. Yeah. Many, many people have asked me that question, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
But not Kempo. In fact, stick and knife fighting is a very big part of Kempo, but only when you get to the advanced ranks. Many people don't realize that there are a thing called Kempo sticks, that they are different somewhat than a screamer in the Filipino arts. This is a very direct system of stick fighting. It is just Kempo with a pair of sticks in your hands. You have to accommodate distance and range for the extension of the weapon from your hand. So that's the only thing that actually has to change. You will use different foot maneuvers and different stances because you have to be farther away from the target initially to be able to use the weapon as opposed to your empty hand.
How was it working with this big man?
This guy was absolutely amazing. Toru Tanaka. His real name is Charles Kalani. He's Hawaiian. And he grew up in the islands with Ed Parker. So that's how we brought Charles Kalani, a.k.a. Toru Tanaka, into The Perfect Weapon. They were childhood friends and grew up together. And here he got to be in the world's first Kempo movie. And he was so thrilled to be in that film and was such a nice guy. And let me tell you, this man was a piece of steel. He was so punk. In these scenes right here where you see him pick me up and throw me around and throw me into boxes and all that, he was really doing that. He was really picking me up. I was almost 200 pounds then. He was picking me up and throwing me around like a rag doll. He was so powerful. It was unbelievable.
Awesome stuff. He gets a nice death scene as well.
Yeah, it's a great explosion, isn't it? Few people will actually experience a great deal of stick and knife fighting in Kempo because it's very difficult to get a black belt in our art. You know, it's a 5-year minimum. It's not for everyone. You actually have to earn it. You can't buy it. And by way of example, if you're with me, you know, as I mentioned, every year we have our event in Las Vegas. Well, it might be 3 or 4 years until you're eligible to test for your next rank. You have to be in that test every year, whether you're testing or not. So your skill level has to be absolutely five stars when you walk in there all the time. We allow no slop and no slack. We do not sell belts. We do not give them away. this year, I was supposed to test for my 10th degree black belt, which will now happen next year in July of 2021. But every single belt I wear, I actually tested for. So 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th are all tests. So I got out on the floor with my black belts and I tested with everybody. That's setting the example for the way that I demand that everybody else follow. Yeah. You know, it's if you want to be a black belt, if you want to be a martial artist, then damn it, go out and earn it. Don't buy it, because then you devalue the martial arts and you even devalue my belt as a fellow martial artist. And I promise you, I earn mine and I make sure everybody earns theirs with me.
No, you shouldn't be giving these black belts out for free. I mean, I remember when I started judo, I was 10 years old. I couldn't grade for my blue belt until I was 16. I mean, that was just it. You're a kid. You can't go for blue until, you know, you're almost a man. And that just seems the way it should be to me.
That's probably when I get along, because we have that same spirit. We have that same respect and honor for the martial arts.
Although I will say the first black belt that I ever got came with my ninja suit that I ordered online, but, you know, that's by the by.
We're back in the days of shooting The Perfect Weapon. Ed Parker was on the set with me every single day. Many of the people who know him all his life said they'd never seen him happier other than the birth of his own children. He was at a complete high of his life, an apex in his career. Finally, his art was coming out to the world through film the way he wanted it done, not the way somebody else wanted it done. He was on the set with me every day, used my trailer as his trailer, brought guests on the set. He was just alive. He was so alive and so thrilled. It'd be 3 o'clock in the morning and he'd be sitting there with me if we were doing a night shoot. You know, I'd go do a take and then I'd come back and sit down exhausted. He'd hand me my water bottle and put my coat on over my shoulders. And we became very, very close. The kind of relationship where you would use, you know, father, son as a very, very accurate acumen.
Did the movie bring you closer together?
Very, very much. We were all already quite close. I had been going to his house every week for 3.5 years, being a personal student of his, learning the art. Then when Perfect Weapon came, he choreographed all the fight scenes with me, as I mentioned, on the set with me all the time. So we finished filming like the second week of November of 90. And then in December 15th of 1990 is when he dropped dead of a heart attack in Honolulu, Hawaii, where he was going home to visit his 94-year-old mother at that time. So that's sort of the point I wanted to make was, since The Perfect Weapon came out, of course, you know, when you have a movie come out, you're editing it, you're working on it, you want to see how the press reacts, you see it. But since that time of March of 1991, I've never watched the movie again. It's just too hard for me to look back at those amazing days of the love and friendship I had with him, all those memories. There's just a ton of memories, extraordinary experiences.
Can I just ask, did Mr. Parker get to see the finished product before?
No.
No.
We had, you know, the set piece fight scene of the movie was in that Taekwondo gym. Yeah. So that was huge, huge fight scene. That had been edited and they brought a copy of it to the set and we watched it in my trailer. So he did get to see that edited, which was a big fight scene. So we were sitting on the couch next to one another. The director put the video in the TV. It started and he began bouncing up and down on the couch, screaming and hooting and clapping and going, "That's it. That's it." I mean, he was completely nuts. He was out of control. He was so happy. So I take a great deal of warmth and happiness and pride in that memory. So he did get to see one of the fight scenes edited and put together, and just thrilled beyond description.
Well, you know, look, the film reached many people and showed Kenpo to many people around the world that may not have known about it otherwise. So, you know, it was a very important thing to do.
Right.
Obviously, if you're into martial arts, you know about it. But if you're not, Perfect Weapon certainly exposed you to it.
Through the success and the efforts that I put forward with the Perfect Weapon, with everybody else, and with Mr. Parker, every other Kenpo school in the world benefited from that. Everybody got students. Everybody became aware of what Kenpo was. And that's a tremendous success story for me, because I was able to help my Kenpo family do better just by getting recognition of the art through the film. So as tragic as it was that Ed Parker had died and wasn't with me when I did all the promotional stuff traveling around the world, it still had this great, great feeling that it's hard to explain, but there's a certain part of the energy of who he was I brought into me, and I took it out to the world. Most of the Kenpo world I hadn't met yet, because I was just coming out. And I was just had such a great sense of accomplishment that I was able to help these people all around the world. Many of them I had never met, and some I still haven't met. But through all my movies, I think I'm so grateful I was able to help the people who share my art of Kenpo karate. So I was signed. All four of those pictures went over to Paramount, and the guy who was the president of the Paramount then at that time, this was also during the time of Godfather 3, which was a nightmare for them, and it cost overruns. And so the guy that took the brunt of that was the guy who was the president of Paramount at that time, who's the guy that signed my contract.
Yeah.
Right at the time of us signing a four-picture deal, so all four of those options with Mark DeSalle went to Paramount, DeSalle wanted me to sign a sidebar contract that if Paramount didn't move ahead, he still had three more options with me. Well, of course, we didn't want to sign that because Mark DeSalle had a terrible reputation in the movie business, and so we knew we were getting started with Paramount. So why would you go from Paramount down to some other level? You want to start with Paramount and go up or stay on the same level at least. Yeah. But Paramount, with me not having any credits, Paramount backed Mark DeSalle. And they told my lawyer, they said, get Speakman to sign the new contract, giving DeSalle three additional options, or we're going to find another actor. So there it was, black and white. No, you can sign the deal and do Perfect Weapon, or you can walk away and we'll get another actor because, frankly, you're nobody. But yeah. Paramount gives me a script that I read, and it's amazing. It's the best script I have ever read. The could be the best movie. It was phenomenal. We take it. That's going to be Speakman's second movie at Paramount. We hire a writer. We're doing rewrites. We're getting everything set. And then when Gary Lucchese got fired at Paramount, a new guy came in. Well, he unknowingly took that script and put it in what they call turnaround, which means it can be sold to other studios. Well, of course, in 24 hours, Fox picked it up. And we find out, and so, of course, we start screaming, what are you doing? You know, you pulled the trigger. You gave me this movie. You are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars rewriting this movie to make it Speakman's second movie. And you sell it, and you give it away. And he went, oh, okay, sorry, I'll get it back. Well, he never got it back. And the name of that movie that was supposed to be my second movie at Paramount was Speed.
Oh, man.
So that went to Keanu Reeves instead of just...
Well, they made a mistake selling it, and they couldn't get it back.
And killed my career in doing it. So then I was now stuck with doing small movies with Mark DeSalle because Paramount was never going to work with him again. So Perfect Weapon was a financial success as well as everything else. But the guy who was responsible for that success was now gone.
So there was a regime change and they want to have their own ideas and all the rest of it. They don't want to inherit somebody else's ideas, even if it's a good idea. It's kind of weird. It
doesn't matter. Yeah. Doesn't matter. Even if you did another financially successful movie with Speakman, the other guy would get the credit. So they, and that thing happens more often than you think.
If speed, would that have been, would you put more martial arts into that?
Yes, it would have been totally a martial art movie. We hired a writer and gave him the directive of within the framework of the movie, the bus would have to stop every so often. I have to get off the bus, which of course puts me into a fight scene, and then get back on the bus or else, you know, the bombs start going off. Yeah. So was already rewriting the movie to make it a Speakman martial art film, which would have been phenomenal. It would have been great.
Well, can I say about Street Night, when I watched it, I was a bit disappointed. I'm going to be honest with you.
Absolutely.
Because I was so impressed with The Perfect Weapon. I'm like, oh, this is the guy now. Come on, let's have more of this guy. And such a geek fanboy of martial arts movies that when I watched Street Night, and you proved yourself to be a good actor in The Perfect Weapon, you know, you almost had a Clint Eastwood quality about you with, you know, very American, understated. It really worked, very cool. And I was a bit disappointed with Street Night because, honestly, there wasn't enough fighting in it for me.
Yeah.
I wanted more fighting. And I think I heard you say that this is because you didn't have the time to do the action that needed to be done. Is that true?
Right, and you'll understand this more than anyone. We didn't have the money to buy the time to shoot the fight as well. Yeah. So the $10 million budget movie got dropped to $3 million. You know, so you have 1/3 of the money to shoot the same kind of movie you just got through shooting, and it was. And so you can't. You just can't.
So in terms of Street Night, then, was it a case of, okay, we don't have the money all the time, so instead of having 7 fights like we did in Perfect Weapon, we're going to have 2 or 3?
You got it. You nailed it exactly right. Because you know, by far and away, the most expensive thing you're going to do are fight scenes and action, car chases, all that stuff. You're going to spend weeks on a car chase and spend a ton of money, and it's going to be, you know, 30 seconds on film. I mean, there's no comparison. If you're going to do an action movie, you'd better have some money backing you up.
Well, let's just have a quick look at some of Street Night, because, you know, you're still getting the job done with the action, even if you have got less time.
Yes.
The 90s blue jeans.
Yeah.
I love those knife hands, though. You seem to have very long arms.
It's all an illusion.
Yeah.
I'm about 6 foot. Tall, and so I've got a pretty
sledgehammers.
This guy I'm working on right here, he was a phenomenal athlete. He actually was competing in the world's strongest man competitions. So normally he'd be another 80 pounds of muscle, but he was back into doing stunt work, so he quit doing the steroids so he could get down to a size like this. But he's still 6'5" and strong as you can believe. Thank God he was a nice guy. You know, we were good friends, but what a great athlete this guy was, to be that big and that strong. You know, he's throwing me around here pretty effortlessly too.
He's quick on his feet as well.
He is, for a big man. Can you believe how quick he's just a great all around athlete.
Tremendous stuff. I love the choreography, the way you're hitting all parts of the body. You know, it's not just a body shot and a head shot. It's
right. Right, that's exactly what Kenpo is. You know, it's an angle of opportunity, we call it. Whatever the target is, if their angle is open, then you take it. And all of these fight scenes are ones that I actually went over with Ed Parker. We spent many, many days at his house making notes and him telling me what he would like to see in future movies. And everything that I did had these Kenpo principles and concepts in them. That's why I have such an enormous respect and reverence for who Ed Parker was and the brilliance of his mind. I mean, I got to know him well. I got to know him very well. And the good news is I got to understand how he thought and understood how he made the art the way he did. So I could then evolve Kenpo into this thing we call Kenpo 5.0, which is this ground fighting base of Kenpo. Yes, I can honestly, clearly say to you or anybody, You know, I'm a martial artist first and an actor second. Through the relative successes that I had with mostly Perfect Weapon, because let's face it, that was by far and away the biggest movie I did. But that propelled me personally into another level of life, of being recognized as a movie star, a celebrity. And that's not important. What is important is what you can do with that. So I was actually contacted in two different occasions by the Make-A-Wish Foundation for young kids who were dying of either cancer or cystic fibrosis. And I was their hero. And they wanted to meet me before they died. So I would travel to their hospitals, go see them in their hospital bed, their parents there, knowing their 13-year-old child isn't going to live much more, much longer, and looking at the stark reality of all of us that are going to transition to the other side. But it's particularly agonizing when it's a young person, especially a young kid. And some kid that looks to you as his hero and says, you know, from his hospital bed, somebody from the Make-A-Wish Foundation comes and says, who do you want to meet? I want to meet Jeff Speakman. He's my hero. What more validation do you need in life than to have that? And if there's one thing I regret, the only regret, is that because of the circumstances that caused my career to decline from Perfect Weapon, I have less opportunities to share that kind of life experience with other people who would need me.
So I know that you had your own battle with cancer in 2013. Throat cancer, was it?
Right, exactly, yeah. And by the time it was discovered, it was actually up to stage 4, which, as you know, stage 5, you're dead. So those were the darkest days of my life, for sure. And I was diagnosed at the end of January in 2013. And then I went to a place called City of Hope here in California, Duarte, California, considered one of the top 3 hospitals in the world for cancer treatment. And I'll look you right in the face and tell you, there's only one reason I'm alive today, and that's because of City of Hope and the people that are there. I was on my way to being dead. In fact, my first meeting with the doctor over there was with the surgeon. And she looked at me and she said, if we do surgery, you're going to have to sign a piece of paper that would allow me to take your voice box, because the cancer has invaded that far into your throat and it's now in your larynx. And she said, you probably won't speak again without some kind of artificial device. And it was at that moment I decided that I would take my own life, that I would not want to live the rest of my life under those circumstances. But it made me stop, freeze frame, and reflect on, okay, if this is the end of your life, were you a good guy? You know, did you accomplish something that was for the common good? Were you just another jerk trying to get more money to buy another house or buy another car? Or did you really care? Did you leave the world a better place? And in the old Japanese traditional world of martial arts, there are 3 things that you should aspire to be a martial artist. And one of them is to know that the world is a better place because you were here. And that's the question I leave for all of you. What is it you're doing with your life that when you die and you're on the other side, just before you go to whatever it is that's on the other side, can you turn around and look at the life you've led and said, yeah, it was a good life, a life well lived, and other people are better in this life because I was here? It makes you think that way. And I was actually honestly able to answer that question. Yes, I believe I was a good person. I've done good things and I've helped a lot of people. And if this is the end, I am not going to go through that surgery. I will simply take my own life. And I began making a thing people call the list. And that is the list of people you're going to call before you die to say thank you for helping me have a better life. And so 3 days after that, I met with the head of oncology and he put his hand on my shoulder and said, we have the cure for this. Now, yeah, exactly. Matt, drink that in for a second. 3 days earlier, the head of robotic surgery, one of the top places in the world, said, I'm going to have to take your voice box if I do surgery. You decide you're going to take your own life and end it. 3 days later, the head of oncology says, "We got this. You're going to make it." Imagine that journey, you know. And when he said that, I just sat there and wept. Yeah. And he just, "Go ahead, take your time. You know, let the emotion come out." Because 3 days ago, I'm in the same hospital with different doctors telling me, "This is it." Yeah. So I said, "Okay, pick a vein and put that stuff in me and let's get it on." So it was a combination of radiation and chemotherapy. So I went 34 sessions, 5 days a week through radiation therapy and 8 chemotherapy sessions simultaneously. Usually you'll do one and then the other. I did them at the same time. In those 33 days, I lost 80 pounds. Because I couldn't swallow, I couldn't eat. I barely could get, you know, an OxyContin pill down my throat to ward off the pain. So I lived that life with 18 inches of hose into my stomach. I could only eat through a feeding tube because I couldn't swallow. And that 18 inches of hose is coiled up and taped to your stomach. So every time you take your shirt off and look in the mirror, you remember how close to death you are. And so I lived that way for 8 months. And I made a commitment. If I come out of this, when I come out, there is no fear. I don't care what anybody thinks, how much you do or don't like me. I know exactly what I'm doing. And I'm going to take Kenpo Karate forward. And we're going to adapt this 5.0 thing and take over the world and get the real meaning of the traditional martial arts out there, which is the opposite of MMA. You know, MMA should be called MMF, mixed martial fighting, because there's nothing artistic in there. Yeah. The only thing you do in MMA is you gain because you cause a man to fall. In martial arts, you gain because you sacrifice something to help another man advance. Your gain is other people advancing. In MMA, your gain is other people falling. And that's why there needs to be a clear delineation between martial arts and martial fighting. And understand that as a martial artist, your job is to make the world a better place, help people, use your intellect and the depth of your spirit and the knowledge that you've gained to help people to have a better life. If you'll do that, then you'll find happiness before you die.
That is so inspiring. That's actually touched me. That's what it's all about, Mr. Speakman.
Totally.
I appreciate you saying that. That is
my pleasure.
Brilliant words.
That comes from the depth of my spirit.
Yeah.
That's the center of my heart. I live that way. I walk the earth that way. I love all of my black belts around the world, and I know that they love me. And we have that incredible relationship where we'll do anything for each other. So the 5-0 family is very strong, and it is set up to continue after I'm dead.
I really appreciate you saying those words. I know it's going to touch a lot of people as it just touched me. I do hope that one day soon I can meet you in person. Maybe when you come over to Europe to do the Kenpo competitions that you were telling me about.
Yes.
I think you are an amazing representative of not just Kenpo Karate, but martial arts in general.
Thank you. You have a standing invitation too. If you ever want to come to Las Vegas, my home is your home. If you can make it here, the third week of July every year is my big event. You would be an honored guest. I would ask you to sit on the testing board for the brown and black belt test, and you will be treated as a respected black belt here, sir.
I would be honored. Thank you so much for the invitation. Yeah,
I'll find a way. You're welcome.
That's wonderful. Mr. Speakman, thank you so much for being on The Art of Action. All the best with your future endeavors. And yeah, I look forward to seeing you in person one day.
A great, great pleasure to meet you, sir. All the best.